I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they create and the poems that created them.
That kind of joy or delight in language pushes me along. This is Chen Chen, and I'm reading my poem called Poem. Racked by doubt, but not yet wrecked by it. I pray to the microwave, the crisper drawer, the lemony dish soap, please fish me out of this funk so I can stop puttering around the kitchen, scarfing fries, chips, every man-made form of potato, including mashed, even stuffed, doubled over by dour. But not yet doomed to it, I mope with some hope, desperately open to the dinkiest sign, trace of sensation, confession. I've succumbed to the starch. I've worn the same band tee 4 days in a row. No one outside the apartment to see. And here you might plead, but wait, and beg, but what about your lover, your recent career luck? And I'd reply, don't you know I hate the words career and lover? I thought you were my best friend, but you're just a paperback copy of Madame Bovary I haven't been able to finish. I've been putting off her suicide for weeks now. It's unbearable to know how someone will die, even a made-up someone who does unlikable things. It's awful knowing how and when and a large portion of why. And really, boyfriend isn't much better. It sounds like we're still preparing for junior prom when we live together. And his mother has no white blood cells because the chemo that's killing the cancer is also killing her. And I should be praying for her. And sometimes I do, but mostly it's for me. The least I could do is not droop and wilt like a bad houseplant. It doesn't give people any strength, this sad, endlessly selfish syntax. Though maybe it's getting better. I used to think I knew how I would die, all tragic like Emma Bovary, but without all the adultery and carriages, and probably not in provincial France. And not that I now believe it's selfish to kill yourself, I don't know, don't want to know how anyone will die or when. Though I like to know generally why, our lives pathetically brief, compared to the bowhead whale, the baobab tree. Perhaps partner is close to what I mean, but it sounds so unsexy. I like to sound sexy again, and strong. Last week, when his mother had a break from chemo, she went beeline to the grocery, craving the most unhospitable of ingredients, hungering to make some real thing and hot. But she couldn't touch anything which could get her sick, which was potentially everything. No, I don't want anyone to die, except Cheney and racist cops and certain Wall Street bastards and the guy who called me a fag and laughed, but they will die, and you and I don't want to know how the book ends, that the book ends. I should pick up the phone and call my mother, ask her about her little vegetable patch out back, if she's planted any more eggplants.
Thank you. Tell me a little bit about the way this poem begins. I go back and back to the beginning lines, racked by doubt, but not yet wrecked by it.
I mean, part of this poem is a sort of pep talk. The speaker is trying to give himself. And I often feel like I start that way, where I'm not starting from a place of great strength or resilience or joy, but I'm trying to maybe write myself there and through the process rediscover some of those more enlivening aspects of myself or the world around me. And so part of how I do that is this focus on sound. And so even when I'm in this sort of stuck place, I still want the music of the language to come through. So the kind of alliteration that's happening in those lines, that kind of joy or delight in language pushes me along, even when there's this feeling of stuckness that I'm exploring.
I love what you said about starting and trying to write yourself into the poem, or into, you know, maybe whatever the poem is going to tell you, rather than sort of starting from a position, as you said, like a position, like a strong position, or like a position of knowing. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that really draws me to your work, that there is an unknowing, and, you know, it reflects the unknowing in all of us, you know. It's just, I just kind of trust these poems, and I want to go wherever they're going to take me. I think I recommended your book to a friend, and I'm looking it up because I want to see what he said. Yes, he said it's so funny. He said a lot of wonderful things, but he described it as being funny and exact, which I love, you know, and it's so true. There's something so exacting about especially your use of image upon image upon image, you know, thing upon thing upon thing, in especially like this poem, and the way that you can kind of course back and forth and weave these many threads. There's Madame Bovary, there's the speaker's boyfriend's mother having cancer, there's the sort of mood of the poet, and all of these, you know, these strands get more and more tightly wound as they go. It's just really magnificent. Really love it. I loved...
Thank you so much.
When I was reading your book, and I don't do this with every book of poems, but I almost read the entire book out loud to myself. maybe that's partly because I'm like never alone in my home because I have two children who are always there, always there and needing something. But I read it over the course of a day, and I just couldn't resist the temptation to read it. And I wonder, I wanted you to talk about how you compose and if while you're composing, you're doing a lot of if you're speaking into the room or... Just can you tell me a little bit about how you tend to compose?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I think I tend to start off in complete silence. I know other folks might have like music playing in the background or they can work somewhere a little more noisy, but I tend to need to just be really quiet at first. And just sit with the page or really, yeah, in front of a screen and to write. But much later in the process, after I have a solid draft or two, and when I'm starting to move pieces around or cut and replace parts of the poem, then, I'll be reading it out loud at that stage and getting a better feel for the rhythm overall. And, yeah, with each subsequent draft, I will read it out loud many times. And lately, because I've been doing all these readings, different schools, different festivals, I will kind of practice these poems, these newer poems, kind of like a comedian with his act, I guess. So I'll try out the new material, so to speak, and I'll get ideas for edits. And at that point, it's usually smaller tweaks that I want to make. But hearing it out loud in front of other people, for some reason, that also sparks something new in how I'm seeing and hearing the poem. Yeah.
That's so cool, the idea that you could be composing, you know, your new work on while you're performing it. And I wonder if when you say you're practicing the poems aloud, are you also seeing how the audience, are you editing or revising by way of like how the audience responds? Or, I mean, does the audience have anything to do with it? Or are you just sort of like saying that you're practicing reading them aloud?
Well, it's interesting with poems, and I think the use of humor in poems, because of kind of the popular perception of poetry still, which I think is that it's, this more serious, lofty endeavor. And so I've read in front of audiences where they really weren't sure if it was okay to laugh. And I could sort of see that on people's faces, or there'd be this kind of nervousness in the room. And once, like, someone else, made more noise in the room, then other people felt more comfortable doing so. So I don't think it's such a reliable gauge of, you know, whether the poem was working, or specifically whether the humor is working in the poem, just going by audience response, because it will be very different from audience to audience, depending on their perception of poetry and sort of what they come into the room expecting or feel ready for. So yeah, I don't really think about it in terms of that. It's more an internal thing that happens, where I'm in front of other people, I'm in front of strangers, and have to, you know, share something new, and so it feels quite vulnerable. And I guess it's a weird combination that I'm trying to reach, where simultaneously I feel confident in the language of the poem, but I feel vulnerable in the kind of emotion or question being explored in the poem. So it has to be both of those things.
I want to talk about the humor in these poems, because not every book of poems has humor in it.
Yeah.
Just stating the obvious, but I was just thinking as I was driving over here about your poems and about, you know, I want to know a lot of things about how you think and how you work with humor, but it just really occurred to me that, like, humor is an instinctual thing, you know, much like poetry is an instinctual thing, but, you know, mm-hmm. It's like sleeping. Like, you can't learn really you can't gain a sense of humor, really. You know, it's like something that's mm-hmm. very instinctual. And I just love the humor in these poems. And I think my students and I read these together, and I think they really did as well. And I would love you to tell me how, like, who are your influences in that vein? And I don't necessarily, maybe they're not mm-hmm. not only poets, so just where do you find yourself, like, you know, in the gravitating toward in the world of humor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so among poetic influences, I would certainly count poet Sarah Gambito. It's a wonderful, wonderful poet, one of the co-founders of Kundiman, which is an organization that supports Asian American writers. And she's just, I mean, brilliant in so many ways as a poet, as a community builder. But her poems just have this pulse and this absurdity to them. That I so appreciate, but I feel like I recognize and I feel recognized by the poems for how they connect humor or the other source of humor comes from really immigrant families and immigrant experiences, and humor as this kind of coping mechanism for the struggles that, you know, many immigrant families go through, but also as, this source of real strength and joy as well. So, you know, not always in response to hardship, but as this sort of reservoir of a feeling, of really deep feeling. So I return to her work often. I think I'm gonna read one of her poems at the end of this conversation. Someone else, one of my best friend, Sam Herschel Wine, another wonderful poet based in Chicago, and we run a journal together called Underblong, and I think the journal really came about from all these conversations that we had that were about kind of the literary landscape and publishing, but also our shared sense of humor. which also, I think, has this very absurd sensibility and a kind of queer sensibility, a shared queer sensibility as well. So those two come to mind. And then outside of poetry, there's this great Australian YouTuber named Nally Tran, who's had this YouTube channel, community channel, for I think over 10 years now. She doesn't update it very much anymore, but I mean, in its heyday, her videos were getting, you know, millions of views. And she still maintains a very funny social media presence. And I just love how kind of dark and sardonic and wry but insightful a lot of her humor is. So yeah, those are some important influences.
It's always struck me as seeming like poems and jokes are similarly constructed. Mm-hmm. You know, in a joke, at the end, the punchline is predicated on the listener having an expectation for how something is going to end, and then upending that. And I feel so much of that, like even in this poem, you know. There's so many moments, you know, I pray, even the, like, even it's just in the, you know, starts out in the second line, racked by doubt, but not yet wrecked by it. I pray to the microwave, the crisper drawer, the lemony dish soap. Please fish me out of this funk so I can stop puttering around the kitchen, scarfing fries, chips, every man-made form of potato, including mashed, even stuffed, doubled over. You know, it's like, the, you know, there's, it's just this sort of, you know, you start with pray and you end with the microwave, and you know, I'm always just so interested in how humor works in poems, and I really love that in this piece.
Well, I mean, I think about line breaks in particular in that piece, and just the nature of line breaks, how you can create suspense and then surprise in the sentence, line by line, because you have these pauses, I love that, how that can work in a poem.
This being your first book of poems, tell me about the experience of, when you have a manuscript and you can, like, in your mind know the number of people who have that book in their hands. You can control it in that way. Right. And then it's published and it goes out in the world and, you know, people in distant lands find connection with it and come to you and say, oh, you spoke my heart. But then also, you know, your family reads it and your, you know, people in your life read it. And tell me a little bit about how it's been having this book, which, I mean, seems a lot about identity and being a self and coming into a self. How has it been having this book go out into the world?
Yeah, I'm still kind of surprised, astonished, whenever someone tells me that they've read my book, even at readings afterward, when someone is already familiar with my work, a student who, you know, was saying, oh, we read it in my class this semester, or they just happened to find it on their own. It's really incredible to me, because in some ways it still feels like, you know, just this Word doc that I had on my computer. So I feel this kind of private sense of attachment to it still. But I felt a great deal of anxiety letting go of it in the final stages of preparing it. and sending it to my publisher. In fact, we went through four rounds of proofs because I kept making very small edits and tweaks. And in fact, the publisher, who is wonderful, but at one point in our email conversation, he told me, you know, usually by the time an author gets, you know, that first set of proofs, that's basically it. So yeah, he was, and the press was just very generous and patient with me, I think in part because it was the first book and they could see how anxious I was about getting everything right or just reaching that point where I had to let it go. I do have highly perfectionist tendencies. And so, yeah, I think I proofread just my acknowledgments a dozen times or more. And I was so nervous about misspelling someone's name, when acknowledging them, or not getting the alphabetical order right when listing everyone. So, yeah, I lost sleep over it, in fact. So it was a struggle, and friends had to kind of console me and tell me, you know, like it's okay, even if like there is, you know, some random typo somewhere. And I was like, but no, there can't be. So yeah, it was its own process. After really the work of writing it, there was this other process of letting it go.
And how about your family's reaction? I mean, were you like a secret poet, or did what was their response?
There have been stages of that as well, because a couple poems from this book first appeared in a chapbook. Actually, there are two chapbooks, but mainly this one called Set the Garden Fire, which came out in 2015, if I remember correctly. My parents had a copy of that. And the poems in that chapbook were already, you know, very, very personal. And they have a copy of my book now, or they've had it for a while. But it's not something we've talked about a whole lot in terms of the content of the book. I think mainly because a lot of what I've written about here, it's already been many years, and we've had many difficult conversations around my coming out, my sexuality, relationships, and yeah, just our dynamic overall. I wouldn't say that we've worked through all of it. I think it's still complicated. It's still a work in progress, as I think, you know, many families and you know, relationships between parents and their children are. You know, it's not very neat and tidy. But yeah, they haven't brought up the content of the poems very much. They tend to focus on sort of the external systems of validation or praise, or whether it will lead to some positive practical outcome, like a job. So they're very happy for my success when it comes to that. If they feel like they can sort of point to, oh, you know, like there's this opportunity now, or you know, because it is their way of thinking about my well-being. Ultimately, I definitely appreciate that in terms of my financial stability. Right. But yeah, I mean, they're proud. They've definitely expressed that in their own ways. Yeah.
How did you first come to poetry? How did you come to write poetry?
So, yeah, I started out as a fiction writer.
Is that right?
I knew probably since second grade that I wanted to be a writer. It had been a dream for a long time. And I don't know. I don't know if what I would call what I wrote at that age, fiction, really. It was kind of more fan fiction. It was also kind of like plays that I would have all my friends act out with me on the playground. And I was very sad when all my friends sort of graduated to more. The accepted games of playing soccer or Foursquare. I loved coming up with our own game and our own way of playing, and so I think that has always been important to me. From these stories and plays or skits. And then starting high school, I wrote more poetry sort of on my own outside of class assignments. And it was really thanks to amazing English teachers that I had, particularly my sophomore English teacher, Miss Kish, senior year, Mr. Felicki, very encouraging supportive teachers who would give me reading recommendations or meet with me during lunch or after school and talk about a poem that I'm working on and, look it over or help me practice, reading it out loud, if I was doing some kind of performance. Just generous, brilliant people. And then it was in college when I took my first poetry workshop, and that was with Martina Spada at UMass Amherst. And that class just opened up so much for me. I felt just really this amazing permission from Espada and from the class to delve into these personal subjects around immigration and sexuality and family in ways that I'd started to before, but really not to this degree, and not with this sense of craft as well going into it. I'm eternally grateful for that workshop.
I want to know what it is about poetry that drew you away from writing, fiction and plays. Mm. What was it about, like, poetry that really drew you, that where you just sort of went toward it? What was it about poetry?
Mm-hmm. I think two things. One, sort of a personal reason, and two, an aesthetic one. But the personal reason was starting high school, because prior to that, my writing took on a very kind of social form. I was sharing it a lot with friends, like I said, on the playground, or then, I was writing this like fantasy novel in middle school, and I would share chapters of it with friends. But then in high school, as I was kind of really coming to terms with my sexuality, but then also thinking about my identity as an Asian American, as a Chinese American, there are just all these things I needed to work out internally, and I think that's a large part of what pushed me into poetry, because I needed to figure these things out for myself. And there are also things that I felt I wasn't completely ready to say to many people, even people that I was close to. And I needed a space that felt more private and more interior and more just emotionally, a place where I could, be emotionally honest on the page in a very real way, much more directly autobiographical, I guess. And then the second reason, the aesthetic reason, is particularly in college when I took that workshop and I took other poetry workshops, I really fell in love with the compression that a poem requires, a lyric poem in particular, how you have to say so much and sort of do so much on the page in such a small space, within a page or two, usually, to create this whole world, and to to populate it with emotions and situations and complexities and surprises, to do all of that. So I love that challenge, and every time something different happens.
So tell me what poem you brought in to share with us, to share with the world.
I'm just delighted to share this poem by Sarah Gambito. It was recently published on poets.org as part of the Poem a Day series. They ask the author in the series to say a little bit about the poem. And so I'll just read what Sarah said about her poem first, and I'll read the poem. She said, "I wanted this poem to be an out-and-out blessing, a zephyr that you don't have to work for." Which I just really love that idea, in this moment of so much awfulness. And I think, we need our poems of outrage and poems of protest and poems of anger, but we also need our poems of tenderness. So this is one of those. Grace. You will transcend your ancestors' suffering. You will pick a blue ball. You will throw it to yourself. You will be on the other side to receive. Green leaves grow around your face. Hair stands on your body. You look at old photographs that say, the bread is warm. A child is a blessing. That's what I said. I meant it. You could say, this is a poem. Like the great halves of the roof that caved and carved together. Found us before words and tender footing. Before wrongdoing. And the octaves of blue above us all.
Oh, what a lovely poem.
Yeah.
This episode obviously won't air today, but it's worth noting that today is election day.
Yeah.
I like hearing that particular poem today because I think, our imaginations are, running wild with all the possibilities of things, getting better, getting worse, not changing. And that's just a really lovely poem to have today.
Mm-hmm.
You can find Chen Chen's poem called Poem in his collection, When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities, out from BOA Editions. This is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.